Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Fellow time travelers, you lovely people. Great to have you with me, with Paul and I. We talk about you all the time, only in a good way, as we travel through space and time together. Paul and I embarked on this journey together long ago now, and here we all are, all united by the same interest in history. This is a history series, and we look to the past to see what lessons can be learned, comfort, inspiration, initiative, aspiration, all of it lying in the past, ready to be stirred up to help us through the difficult days of the present. If you want to help support what Paul and I do, it's the patreon.com site that is the conduit for the finances that makes the rest of the podcast series possible. So if you want access to exclusive content, and if you want to join the family, and if you want to be part of the wider community of curious-minded people, go to patreon.com, search for me by name, part with a bit of cash, and I'll see you there. Okay, that's the end of the advert. It's time to strap into the time machine as we set off towards the next stop in my love letter to the world. Recorder, microphone, action. A little girl dressed in red, small, bright, and irreplaceably precious. She climbs aboard an aircraft, Pan Am Flight 103. She's with her family, and they're on their way from London to New York. Endeavouring to understand history in hopes of illuminating the future, I'm Neil Oliver, and this is my love letter to the world.
Morning, Neil. In the last episode, it was 1973 in Paris. A Solzhenitsyn published his groundbreaking work, The Gulag Archipelago. Where are we this week?
Hello, Paul and fellow time travellers. Yes, that brave and uniquely incredible book by Alexander Solzhenitsyn lifted a corner of the Iron Curtain to reveal some of the horror within. This week, it's horror of another sort. We're travelling to the skies above Scotland to witness an evil event that spread tragedy right across the globe. We're with a three-year-old girl called Saruchi Ratan in the sky over the small town of Lockerbie. Today, we're everywhere and nowhere, actually. This is really related more to thought in many ways than to a place, although events unfold in a location, but it's something that's bothered me for a long time. It relates specifically to a little girl called Saruchi Ratan. I'll explain her in due course, but it's a thought and a story that's haunted me ever since I heard it. My most recent book is called Hauntings. Have I got it here? It's kicking about some. There it is. Hauntings. I'm not just making this up. It's ostensibly about ghosts and ghost stories. But really, as I got it up and running, the book became more about having the chance to consider the ways in which we are as human beings, or the ways in which we seem to be affected individually and collectively by things we can't always detect with the usual senses. So all of us in our lives, I would say, whether we believe in ghosts or the paranormal or phenomena, I think everyone, at least once or twice, has a moment where there's a a synchronicity of events, or there's a bizarre coincidence, or there's a glimpse or a feeling or a sensation in a place that just for a moment makes you go through what the parapsychologist Archie Roy, fellow countryman of mine, described as a sense of something strange. And the story that I'm coming to and the sensation around it always has given me pause for thought. Believe it or believe it not, but I am slightly haunted by a little girl in red. And I concede right away that it's one of those claims that a person might make where I don't know whether it's something I've inflicted on myself semi-consciously. I don't know whether I'm seeing a pattern where there is none because I'm looking for it subconsciously. And I certainly can't point specifically at when it started. Perhaps I saw something once and it caught, you know, like a barbed hook somewhere in my consciousness. And I've been looking out for it ever since. I don't know, but I'm open to the possibility that it's coming out of my unconscious, my subconscious. When I said little girl in red, I'm sure lots of people, depending on your age and vintage, will think of the little figure in red in the Donald Sutherland, Julie Christie sort of semi-horror flick called Don't Look Now. If you haven't seen it, it's a bit of a... It's of its time, I suppose. You'd probably say it's dated. It's a bit of a 60s oddity. Maybe it's early 70s, I can't remember. Or, for people of a slightly younger mark, the little girl in the red coat in Steven Spielberg's Schindler's List. I suspect most people who've seen that film were struck by the sequence where it's in black and white, or a very leached out colour scheme of the Warsaw Ghetto being dealt with by the Nazis. And there's a little girl in a red coat, a bright red, she's the only spark of colour in the whole sequence. And she's kind of moving about and no one's noticing her. All sorts of terrible things are happening. And she's kind of just moving through it. And everyone seems to be oblivious to her presence. That's also part of it. But years ago, I wrote a book and I made a television series called Vikings. And we looked at Swedish, Danish and Norwegian people who went a Viking from about the 8th century onwards, Viking being a seaborne adventure. That's to go Viking. And it was a wonderful project because I got to see all over Scandinavia. And I certainly hadn't seen much of it before, and I got a really good look around it. And as part of the filming, I visited the National Museum in Stockholm. And we went there specifically. We went there more than once. But on the occasion that matters to this, we went to see the remains of a little human being who is known colloquially as Birka Girl. And Birka Girl refers to the skeleton of a little girl aged about 10 when she died, who was buried in the 10th century in the cemetery, the graveyard of the village of Birka on the island of Björkö in Lake Mälaren in southern central Sweden. And it was a Viking village on an inlet from the sea, and it was a trading centre. People were coming and going from it, taking stuff, bringing stuff. The little girl lived there, died there, and Birka kind of went to sleep, not long after really her time, into a kind of brigadoon. The place was abandoned. You know how a lot of places might have 10th century roots, but they've been built on and built on and built on and all that. But people went away from Birka and never went back. And so it's been excavated as a kind of an untouched Viking settlement. And this little girl was found in a coffin. And it was in the 19th century when she was found, and she was excavated. And there were all sorts of strangeness about her. Although she was about 10, she was very, very small by the standards of a 10-year-old, bird-like, tiny little figure, very thin bones and whatever. But nonetheless, she'd been buried in possibly the prime spot in the whole graveyard. Nobody got a better plot. So you have to think, why? To whom did she matter that they treated her this way? And as well as giving her the prime real estate in the graveyard, she was buried with quite a lot of finery. She had a gilded brooch pinned to her dress. It was on here, about her breastbone, really. And she'd been buried with a wee bone, beautifully made bone container that was had been hollowed out so that it had a lid that fitted on top. And inside it were little bone needles. And they would have been the mark of an adult woman, like a kind of a rite of passage gift, like a sort of a 21st birthday present type thing. But this little girl had been given this, which was a bit odd because she was obviously just a child. She had a necklace of beads around her neck, glass beads, multicoloured. And also, because of the other finery, and they could see on the back of the gilded brooch the weave of a fabric, i.e. the dress to which this brooch had been fixed for the little girl to be laid. And so there was an assumption made that she was probably dressed for her funeral in a good dress. And the hardest, the most expensive colour to come by in the 10th century in that part of the world would have been red. If you were going to show off a bit, red was the colour. So the assumption was made, although there was no fabric in the little girl's coffin with her, the assumption was that she was probably wearing red. So as part of the exhibit of Birka Girl, as she's come to be known, there's a little maquette, a little model. Her skull was rebuilt. It was all flattened by the passage of time and whatever. It was, you know, like crushed like a walnut. But her skull was rebuilt, and from that they reconstructed what she might have looked like. And it's a funny face, actually. There's a thinking that she may have been born to a woman who was alcoholic. There's a syndrome that can be sort of passed on to an infant who gestates in the womb of a woman who's drinking a lot of alcohol. And it creates an appearance that it's a little bit like Down syndrome, a little bit like a wide face maybe, and a bit of an unfamiliar distance between nose and top lip. And they've got her dressed in a wee red dress. And there's this little figure, but this height, you know, like 3.5 feet high sort of thing. And kind of haunts your imagination when you see her. And so ever since, I've thought about her, because I've got a wee girl. Well, I've got a big girl now. Nearly 21, but I always used to think about Birka Girl in relation to my daughter, as anyone would. You tend to project, don't you? And so she's always been in my metaphorical peripheral vision, Birka Girl. She's really my little girl in a red dress. I wonder who she meant so much to, this little bird-like kid. You can imagine her sort of running along the waterside in Birka, watching the boats coming and going, and hearing all the different voices and all the different accents of travellers and strangers and that world that she was a part of for a very brief period. And then when she died, they gave her the best funeral and buried her in the highest point in the graveyard overlooking the town. It's all very evocative. So she's been in my mind since that excavation, but much further back, before I ever encountered Birka Girl. I studied archaeology at Glasgow University in the 80s, and I retrained as a journalist later. So I was at university from 1984 to 1988, and on the 21st of December 1988, Pan Am 103 came down on Lockerbie. The Lockerbie air disaster, the Lockerbie tragedy. You know, long before 9/11, this was the devastation caused by the impact of a big plane. And I remember it because on the night that the news started to break, it came down on the town of Lockerbie, which is a farming town in the southwest of Scotland, an unremarkable place, and one of those that's been put on the map really only because of a tragedy, a bit like Aberfan in Wales that people have only heard of because of the great slump of slurry from the coal waste that got waterlogged and slid and killed all the children and the teachers in the school. Lockerbie's a bit like that. People only know about it because something tragic happened there. And on the night in question, it was coming up to Christmas, obviously, 21st of December 1988, and Trudy and I was in Trudy's mum and dad's house in Falkirk, and we heard the news. There was news started to come through on television and on the radio and it wasn't clear what had happened. I remember initially they thought that a light plane, a little plane, had come down on a filling station, and you know, and caused a fire with the petrol pumps, because it was a terrible fire. They couldn't work out what happened at first, and then gradually, the truth of it was revealed. And what it was a Boeing 747 called the Maid of the Seas had been en route from Heathrow Airport in London, and it was supposed to turn left out across the Atlantic and land in JFK, John F. Kennedy Airport in New York. But a bomb, an explosive hidden in a suitcase, had exploded in the suitcase was with all the other luggage in one of the forward luggage holds in the belly of the plane, and it exploded and the plane broke in two, and the cockpit went sort of one way and the rest of the plane went the other way, and people were just raining down. Passengers still belted into their seats fell out, and a big part of the plane, you know, and it landed by sheer bad luck on the town of Lockerbie. It landed in a place called Sherwood Crescent, which was just a wee suburban houses. It landed on top of them and the fuel ignited and was a terrible conflagration. It fell from 31,000 feet or something, and 259 passengers and crew were killed, obviously, and 11 people on the ground in those houses, you know, that the plane landed on top of, and it was a terrible fire. And all the wreckage was scattered over 900 square miles of territory. And I know that a lot more of the detail than maybe most, because it happened in 1988 when I was still an archaeologist. But I couldn't get enough work as an archaeologist, and so I retrained as a journalist. I joined a local paper and got trained as a journalist. And the paper that I joined was the Annandale Herald, which was based in Lockerbie. And this was in the early 90s, sort of 1991, by which time the Lockerbie inquiry was underway. All the testimony was being given as people were piecing together, in, you know, still in the aftermath of it, exactly what had happened. And the Lockerbie event, because it happened in Scotland, it became the biggest and the most complicated by a long way criminal investigation in Scottish legal history. It just happened to happen on Scotland. Tiny Scotland became responsible for leading on this investigation, and it became the Lockerbie inquiry. And so all of that's the nature of the tragedy. But one of the stories that came out was about a little Indian girl called Saruchi Ratan. And she was three years old, and she was travelling with her family, a family of five, a party of five, and they were en route from Delhi to Detroit. They were going out to America to visit family. And little Saruchi was in a little red, like a little shalwar kameez thing, you know, the little like red tunicky top and the red trousers. A toddler. And they had several connections to make for the journey. So they had got on a plane in Frankfurt, which took them to Heathrow. And they should have been in one of those what ifs. She and her family, they should have been on an earlier flight that would have connected with an earlier scheduled aircraft making the hop from Heathrow to JFK. But as their plane in Frankfurt was taxiing towards the runway, a little boy, I think it might have been her brother, but another child in the party took ill on the plane, and the pilot made the quite unusual decision, really, given that it was another big plane. I think it was a Boeing 727. He turned it around and took it back to the gate and let the whole family off. And then that plane then continued with its journey to Heathrow. And the Ratan family joined a later flight, which took them to Heathrow in time to catch, by terrible bad luck, Pan Am 103. But when they were on the flight from Frankfurt to London, the wee girl was quite the, you know, the eye-catching presence for all the other passengers, because she was in bright red and she was a pretty wee thing. And she was toddling up, and there was testimony of her seen, you know, toddling up and down the aisle during the flight and playing peekaboo between the headrests, you know, the way kids do, you know, they looking back, saying hello to the people in the row behind. And she struck up a little tiny rapport with an American, a young man who only really seems to be in the record as Chaz, Charles something or other. And he was just one of the people on the flight from Frankfurt to Heathrow who noticed Saruchi Ratan and was, you know, maybe playing a little bit of the peekaboo with her and whatever, and seeing her toddling up and down the aisle. And then that plane arrived at Heathrow. Chaz went on his way. He didn't get on Pan Am 103. He got on another flight to another destination. That was it. But Saruchi Ratan and her family got on Pan Am 103, and the rest is dreadful history. And in the aftermath of what happened at Lockerbie, in that way that people do, they sent about a million bouquets of flowers. You know, in the aftermath of when Diana, Princess of Wales, died, and the bouquets were piled high, and the whole London smelled of, you know, cut flowers. Well, the same thing happened at Lockerbie in 88, and flowers just kept on coming and kept on coming, and they were heaped up all around the town hall and all over the place. People didn't know what to do with them. And this whole story of the little girl in red came out because amongst the countless bouquets, one of the little cards on a bunch of flowers said, "To the little girl in the red dress who made the flight from Frankfurt such fun, you didn't deserve this. God bless, Chaz." And that was it, that whole story of the little girl in red came out of that card and that bunch of flowers in amongst the mountains of flowers that were sent by broken-hearted people, members of the public and people connected to people aboard the flight and so on and so on. And so the legend of the little girl in red of Lockerbie was born. 270 people died. There's a memorial now, a big memorial garden in Lockerbie. I was there. I did some of the coverage of the Lockerbie inquiry. Sherwood Crescent, where the plane obliterated it, you know, that's where the, you know, there's a garden of remembrance now, and so on and so on. And it was just the most appalling thing. I mean, it was appalling full stop, but that Lockerbie was hit by it was also a tragedy in its own right. You know, Lockerbie was just going about its business on the night of the 21st of December, and this happened to it. And then the whole thing unfolded. America decided that Libya was to blame. Their investigation led them to say that it had been a plot that had, you know, been hatched out of Libya. And eventually in 1992, on account of crippling sanctions, the Libyan leader, the late and now Muammar Gaddafi, Colonel Gaddafi, he surrendered eventually to intelligence officers, to government intelligence officers, and they were called, because I was in the paper, I'm one of the few people on the planet that remembers that their names were Abdel Basset Ali Magrahi and Lamin Khalifa Fima. These were the two men. And they were brought over and they went to trial in Scotland, and Lamin Khalifa Fima was acquitted of all charges, but Abdel Basset Al Magrahi was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. And now I look back on it, and I do wonder, you know, at the extent to which it's even believable that it was those two men that were anything to do with it. And I think the responsibility for what happened lies elsewhere. I really don't think, looking back on it now, that those two individuals were like patsies. You know, they were like Lee Harvey Oswalds that got the albatross of the atrocity hung around their necks. And Magrahi went to prison for it, and Fima was sort of tainted by association. Magrahi was released in 2009 on humanitarian grounds. He had prostate cancer. He was dying. And he was allowed to go home. And it's a bit odd that, you know, that you'd have thought guilty of the premeditated murder of all those people, that prostate cancer or not, that he was sent home. after a number of years in prison. I look back on that, I think, slightly odd. Anyway, he died. Eventually, he died in 2012, and he's still protesting his innocence. They both did throughout. Fema and Megrahi said throughout that it was nothing to do with them, that they didn't do it, they had nothing to do with it. Whatever. Take from that what you will. Look back over the limitless amounts of information that there are about it. And, you know, it was fully 13 years before 9/11 when two other planes caused mayhem. But Pan Am 103, Pan Am's gone now. You know, that airline company folded and was obliterated by the whole, you know, by the consequences and the compensation and all of the rest of it. But Pan Am 103 changed the world. It was overtaken by 9/11, but Pan Am 103, which a lot of people have forgotten about, or people too young don't even know much about it. But the world's teeth were set on edge by Pan Am 103. The threat to aircraft was in everyone's minds from that point on. And as I say, I put Suruchi Ratta and the little girl in red in the book because at the time, long before I came to write Hauntings, I was already haunted by her. She comes in and out of my mind, in and out of my peripheral vision. I'll see a flash of red somewhere. I'll see someone, a child even, and I'm immediately taken back to thinking about her. And I wonder about that. And I think it's because, in part, I think we're hunters. You know, the story of the world in 100 moments, you know, it's about history. It's about the sequence of events that our species has passed through in 5,000 years. But always I'm thinking as an archaeologist about the deeper depth of the human story. And our species, Homo sapiens, has been dotting about on the planet for, it's anybody's guess really, say 300,000 years, give or take. And because we're hunters, even though we live 21st century lives now, obsessed with mobile phones and the internet and so on and so on, we're still running on hunter software. That's our operating system, never upgraded. We run hunter OS. And because of that, our eyes are caught involuntarily, inadvertently by things, flashes, things that move, patterns. We see them, can't help it. And I think that in part that's why I think had my eye caught by the little girl in red, the story of her, the thought of her, the image of her, you know, because our eyes are caught by things that are small and bright and captivating. And amongst those for me is the little girl in red, Suruchi Ratan, irreplaceably precious, as every child is. And I think about her often. Ur and Babylon, Egypt, Persia, Greece and Rome, empires rise and fall, millions of souls on the move from east to west, war, war and war again. And then came the 20th century and all hell broke loose. Next time in my love letter to the world. To help support this podcast and to get access to new content every week, sign up to the Neil Oliver site on patreon.com, why don't you? Be great to see you there. I have a new website address, nice and simple, neiloliver.com. Check out my shop for series merchandise, t-shirts and mugs and hoodies and so on. My Instagram account is Neil Oliver Love Letter. My YouTube channel is the Neil Oliver Channel and it features new films every week. And to help build this podcast, tell your friends about it. Get them listening and write a review to convince the online crowd that they should join us. For further reading about these moments in time, you could try my book. It's called The Story of the World in 100 Moments and it's published by Transworld. Neil Oliver's Love Letter to the World is produced by Paul Ratcliffe and Neil Oliver for Catnip Inc. Music is composed by Milo McKinnon. Social media and YouTube producer is Oscar CFR. Additional research is by Evie, Lucien, Archie and Teddy. Finances by Catherine and Trudy. Post-production is by Squared Studios and the graphics are by Paul Plowman. Thanks for listening. This has been a Catnip Inc. podcast's production.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.